Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that examines and celebrates one episode at a time the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which ran on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Corporal Captain Rob Kelly, and joining us this week in the VIP tent is our old friend, Captain Kevin Lauderdale. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Rob. I am so pleased to be here. I am so happy. Ever since you started teasing the idea of a MASH podcast, I've been just chomping at the bit. I can't wait. More importantly, I am now a five-timer. I did four episodes of Film and Water with you. This is my first of hopefully several episodes of MASHcast. Five times. I think I should probably stake out a claim to any episode where they watch a movie. So I could do the one where they watch My Darling Clementine, where they watch The Moon is Blue, and of course, any episode featuring the fine products of the Tabasco Film Company of Havana, Cuba.
There really does need to be a whole episode devoted to the output of the Tabasco Film Company. I feel like that really does deserve its own half hour at the very least. Well, yeah, I'm thrilled to have you here. I've really been enjoying your appearances with me on Film and Water, and so it's great to have you over here on MASHcast as well. So this is terrific.
Yay.
All right, so we're here to talk about Season 1, Episode 15, Tuttle, which is a really great one. Originally aired January 14th, 1973. It was written by Bruce Shelley and David Ketchum and directed by William Weord. But before we get to the episode, Kevin, I have to ask you, like, what's your history with MASH the show?
I have always watched it. I was one of the original latchkey kids. So I'd come home, turn on the TV just to have some sort of background noise so I was doing my homework or something like that. I grew up in Los Angeles, and there was an hour block, two episodes, of the show in syndication. And at first, it was just something to have on. You know, it was funny. I would get, you know, some of the jokes, but not a whole lot. It's the mid to late 70s. I'm watching a show set in the 50s where the cultural references are from the 30s and 40s.
Right.
But I would, you know, maybe ask my mom, who was Truman? Or maybe even look up something in an encyclopedia. But the show was always funny. I would always get at least the top level of humor. And, of course, it was gorgeous to look at. Nothing had the level of detail of, like, the swamp or the offices. And eventually I learned that there were new episodes of MASH being created. I was watching, you know, something from a few years back. But during Christmas vacation or summer vacation, I'd suddenly see Colonel Potter. Who's he? Charles Emerson Winchester III. Who's he? And so I'd get to see two levels of MASH. And, of course, the later ones are a little more sophisticated and deeper than the earlier ones. But I was watching MASH at the height of its fame. And you've talked about this before in a couple other episodes where you'd see, you know, Loretta Swit on the cover of People magazine. And TV Guide had those special, you know, half-page call-out if there was an episode like Lifetime where there's a 20-minute, you know, clock, you know, the Aorta one.
Right, right.
Just everywhere. And if you went to the Bungalow News bookstore on Colorado Boulevard.
Great name.
Yeah. There was actually a spinner rack that had the MASH novels. And we're not just talking about the two canonical ones, MASH and MASH Goes to Maine, but all these other bizarre ones, MASH Goes to Moscow, MASH Goes to Means. These were written by supposedly by Hooker, but with William E. Butterworth, who I think is actually W.E.B. Griffin, the thriller writer. Have you ever read any of those, the newer ones?
I read one of them not that long ago. I will admit I have a real tough time with the MASH novels. I read them for historical sort of, you know, historical history. That makes no sense. I read them just because I'm curious, not because I enjoy them. I just don't think they're funny, and they're versions of the characters that I frankly just don't recognize, even though, of course, you know, the original novel comes from the man who created the character, Richard Hooker. I don't know, I find them mean and not particularly funny, but I keep trying to go through them because I'm just sort of, again, I'm just sort of curious.
Yeah, don't waste your time. I've read okay. Four of them, and they take place, first of all, after the series,
right,
with
right.
characters from the very beginning of the series. So there's no Potter, there's no BJ. I mean, I think Spirit Chucker's in there and Duke, but they made the mistake that, say, the Star Trek novels didn't, in that these take place far afterwards. So Radar is like a fast food mogul having made millions of dollars off Mother O'Reilly's frozen Irish stew. And And Margaret is like the leader of a religious cult. I mean, they just aren't particularly interesting. They aren't particularly mashy. I don't recommend them. But what's interesting, talking about my relationship with MASH, isn't that I watched MASH. What's interesting is all of my old friends watched MASH too. I mean, and admittedly, this was a self-selecting group of people I played Dungeons and Dragons with. But having listened to your podcast, and thank you very much for getting Hulu to put it back up. I really appreciate that. And rewatching the episodes, two things have struck me. Why was this such a popular show among 7th, 8th, 9th graders? That's when we were really watching it. Number one, I think there is a very real analog between being a kid and being in the Army. When you're a kid, other people are telling you where to go, when to be there, what to eat, where to eat. If you're in school, you even have orders. Okay, there's a test on state capitals on Friday. Your orders for the week, memorize these state capitals. But more importantly, that's when you're starting to challenge authority and to question inconsistencies and hypocrisies. School laws say I have to wear a tie. Fine, I'm going to wear it as a belt. I'm not going to wear it around my neck. There's no rule that says I have to wear it around my neck. And as you're challenging authority, who are better role models than the Dr. MASH? These guys challenge authority with wit and intelligence. Most of the guys we see rebelling in pop culture are just jerks. You know, thank you, Marlon Brando. I appreciate your performance in The Wild One. But you know, what are you rebelling against? What do you got? That's not going to help me as I'm growing up. What helps me as I'm growing up is seeing people challenge, oh, I don't know, the greatest insanity that mankind inflicts upon itself, war, and seeing doctors challenge the idea that just because authority has declared this person over here is the other, I should go kill them. I really think MASH helped me grow up, not to get too heavy, as a person.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's we've talked about it, as you've said in previous episodes, about that so many young kids tuned into the show literally and figuratively, and I always kind of wondered why, because as you said, it's got these ancient references and it's talking about stuff that kids don't relate to, except that central premise of what you just said, of that when you're a kid and you're in school, everybody's telling you what to do, and here at the Army unit, everybody's telling our main characters what to do, and they're rebelling against it. And it's kind of like why Bill Murray was so popular, kind of in his heyday, because he had that smart ass, he kind of, I just make fun of everything and I get away with it kind of persona. And so, yeah, when you're a kid, you really are rooting for Hawkeye and Trapper and later on BJ, because they are just, they are refusing to go by the authority that has been in, that is looming over them. I mean, Hawkeye has that great line in the episode, The Interview, where he talked about the first thing that was so surprising to him when he joined the Army was everybody thought they had a right to tell me what to do. He said, that was amazing to me. And like, that was an interesting idea to think of, that like, there's people going around saying, I have the right to tell you what to do. And Hawkeye is one of those people. It's like, no, you don't. No, no, you don't. And so, yeah, if you're a kid, you're that's right in there, right in your mind. You're like, yeah, I don't want to be told what to do. And I'm watching these two guys thumb their nose at everybody. That's great. I love it.
Yep.
It's a terrific. Did you watch the final episode when it aired live?
Yes, I did. So I watched. I'm trying to think. There was a gap where I didn't watch a whole lot. I think that may have been around the time I discovered Girls. But I definitely watched reruns and I watched some new ones. And it was a gap. And then I probably watched like the last year. I think I was in college. I watched that last season. I knew it was the last season. And then there was more of a gap. But then once I had kids, I was waiting for just the right time. I was slowly but surely introducing them to certain episodes. Like we watched some Chris episodes. We watched some other ones. This episode we're talking about, Tuttle, happens to be one of the great first episodes to show people, because you don't have to know much about war. You don't have to know much about medicine. And then I would occasionally stumbled upon MeTV or Cozy, and we should watch a little more. And then once Hulu was on, and they're at a certain age, like one's like 17, one's 14. I'm like, you guys want to watch some MASH? Like, yeah, sure. We can binge watch like three episodes in a row and things like that. So I'm coming back to it. And of course, listening to your podcast, it's like, I know what's coming up. I'm going to watch that episode. Listen to what people are talking about.
Outstanding. Very, very cool. So, well, yeah, as you mentioned, we're here to talk about Tuttle. As I mentioned, it aired on January 14th, 1973. Hawkeye and Trapper are making a secret donation of medical supplies to a local orphanage. When Sister Teresa asks who is responsible for such a large act of generosity, Hawkeye sputters, Captain Tuttle. Trapper goes along. Figuring this was the best way for the donations not to be tracked, Hawkeye and Trapper assume that that's that. Except the name Tuttle starts to spread through the camp like wildfire. Frank wonders why this Tuttle hasn't reported to him. He is second in command, after all. Henry assigns him to be officer of the day, and he even manages to make Frank jealous after Hotlip mentions how attractive she finds Captain Tuttle to be. Tuttle even manages to collect a huge wad of back pay, Hawkeye with his surgical mask on, pretending to be Tuttle, but not before telling the paymaster that all his future earnings are to go to Sister Teresa's orphanage. Sensing the need to beef up their lie a little bit, Hawkeye, Trapper, and Radar break into the camp's personnel records and forge Tuttle's profile. After giving him a sterling medical credentials, Hawkeye throws in something for Hot Lips, making Tuttle a real looker. The Tuttle eye grows so big that General Clayton arrives to give the captain a medal for his extreme generosity. Now what? During the ceremony, Hawkeye has to break the grim news that Captain Tuttle has died while at the front helping wounded soldiers. Leaping from a helicopter, he had everything he needed except his parachute. Later, Radar wonders where Hawkeye and Trapper got the uniform and dog tags. Trapper insists they're on loan from Major Murdoch, Tuttle's replacement. So, yep. So Kevin, like, what do you think of this episode?
This is one of my favorite episodes of the entire series, possibly my favorite episode of this season. Doesn't mean it's the best episode of this season. We've still got Sometimes You Hear the Bullet, but I love this episode. It really spoke to me as a kid. And again, you don't need to know much about war or medicine, but as a kid, and even as a grown-up, we all know the importance of paperwork. I mean, you're a kid, here's a piece of paper with an A on it. That's great. Piece of paper with a B, okay. Piece of paper with a C or a D might need to be countersigned by your commanding officer. So it's just the fact this plot is so audacious that through paperwork, a non-existent person can sort of take on a life of his own. Plus, this episode is, how do I put this, better written than it needs to be. I mean, this could be an episode of any workplace comedy. And I think we both said that MASH is television's finest workplace comedy. I mean, this could be an episode of Frasier, a show I like, wherein doing some weird paperwork, somebody thinks there's a new program director, and you know, wackiness ensues. But the writers of this episode use this idea to really get into the characters, particularly Frank and Margaret. They don't have a lot of extended scenes, but the lines they have, Tuttle becomes a sort of tabula rosa that people project their desires he's into. I mean, he literally goes from being Hawkeye's imaginary friend to Frank's imaginary friend. It's just utterly fascinating. I love this episode.
Yeah, it's, you mentioned the writers, Shelley and Ketchum, and it's weird because this is their only MASH credit. This is the only one they ever wrote, which is very strange because this is one of these shows that you said it's better written almost than it needs to be. Because it is so well written, this episode remains really, really funny and really entertaining when the premise could collapse in on itself. Because this is such an absurd premise. The characters are acting, especially like Henry and stuff, where he gets teary-eyed. He was the best OD officer we ever had. It could make everybody look stupid, except for Hawkeye and Trapper, who are, of course, in on it. But it doesn't. It just sort of works. Like, the ridiculousness of it sort of works. And this episode does stand unique in that it features the only meta joke I believe MASH has ever done, which is in the end credits, when it's listing all the supporting cast, it lists Captain Tuttle as himself, which is, I'll go through it all as we go through all these episodes, but I really think that is the only time MASH ever did that kind of joke, a meta joke. And I feel like that's what makes this episode so unique. It's almost like a fever dream that everybody had. It would be the kind of thing where if in a later episode Hawkeye had mentioned Captain Tuttle to BJ, it would feel discordant. It would be like, wait, that feels like a different show than the one that they did here. It just sort of works, even though it probably shouldn't. And I think that has to do with the direction by William Wiard, who directed a bunch of MASH episodes. He did Love America. He also did Love American Style, Can and the Rockford Files, Spencer for Hire. He directed the episodes of The Doris Day Show, which had McLean Stevenson in the cast. He also directed the briefly running show Rollout, which was a show by Gene Reynolds and Larry Gelbart about an army unit, which is sort of like a way for them to sort of capitalize on their MASH success. That we have to do a whole episode on Rollout because that's like a fun little coda to MASH's history. And as I said, it's written by Shelley and Ketchum, who wrote The Love Boat, Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Love American Style. I mean, none of their credits are particularly noteworthy, necessarily. I haven't seen these episodes. But, I mean, this is a really well-written episode, and I'm kind of amazed this was their only shot at writing MASH.
It's also an interesting lesson in the television industry. I had not seen this episode in a long time when I watched it. When you announced you were doing it, I said, oh, I got we watched Tuttle, want to see it again. However, prior to the invention of the VCR, I used to record the audio of certain episodes off television. And I had this, I would listen to them as I was going to sleep and things like that. In fact, had you caught me around ninth grade, I probably could have done a one-man show of this, Adam's Ribs, the monologue episode, and I knew these backwards and forwards. But something really interesting hit me, which is watching these on Hulu, I see that there was basically an entire scene cut, a two-minute scene, it's a third scene, where Radar goes to Henry. In the syndication, it had simply been the invention of Tuttle, smash cut to attention, Tuttle is now the officer of the day. And with the removal of that scene, my entire view of Henry was shifted. Because here's what happens. In that scene, Radar basically convinces Henry that he has actually met Tuttle. So right. In the fullness of the episode, Henry thinks there really is a Tuttle. Whereas in the edited version, which is the one I grew up on, I thought Henry was just a jerk, like everybody else, pretending to have met him. And as I've been watching the episodes, I've grown to like Henry more and more. I still prefer Sherman Potter, but I think there's a certain decency and humanity to Henry that he sort of goes along, and what he thinks is real is real. And so by cutting that scene, I really had sort of a shifted, jerky view of Henry. Yeah, he's going along, you know, pretending like everybody else. But I think he's a fuller, more affectionate. I'm able to like Henry more in this episode, knowing that he actually thinks he thinks Tuttle is real, even though he's not.
Right. I mean, Radar has got him so snowed at this point that you really do believe that Henry believes that he's met Tuttle. Mm-hmm. There's the scene where he's talking to Frank and Hot Lips, where they want to check up on him, and he says, "I had breakfast with the man only yesterday." And part of me is like, Henry really believes that. Yeah. He really believes that he did have breakfast with the man. And I mean, now later on, he says, "I told Tuttle I'm having lunch with him." Now that's a lie. Clearly knows that's a lie. But the breakfast line, I think, yeah, Henry's memories are so sort of scattered that, yeah, that's what he thinks. And so, yeah, that scene is, it's funny when you watch these syndicated edits, they can really take a meat cleaver to the show sometimes. They really cut out. I mean, I know they have to cut something out, but often they really decimate some of the shows with some of the motivations or some of the background. It's a shame they had to hack them the way they did. Oh, this episode is also historical in that we meet for the first and only time Sparky.
Yay!
The infamous Sparky, yes, that Radar is always talking to, who apparently over the course of the series never got transferred home. he's mentioned in like the second episode, and he's mentioned in like the next to last episode. So Sparky never got rotated home. He's played here by Dennis Fimple, great name, who appeared on shows like Alias, Smith & Jones. He was in a movie, The Apple Dumpling Gang. He was in the 1976 King Kong. Matt Houston, one of his last credits, he's no longer with us, is in the Rob Zombie movie House of 1,000 Corpses. He's reading a Captain Marvel annual, as he says. He thanks Radar for sending it to him. It's funny when I watch these episodes where they mention Captain Marvel, which is more than once. He's been mentioned on the show a couple times. When you think about it, this is 1972-73. Captain Marvel was out of pop culture. This was before DC had started publishing him again. So he had not been around anywhere for 15 years. But that's how popular Captain Marvel was. I mean, of course, he was mentioned on Gomer Pyle, the Shazam, Shazam. But that's how much Captain Marvel / Shazam was part of the culture, was that you could reference him on a TV show 15 years later and people expected you to get the reference. That's how preeminent Shazam was, which is remarkable.
Also in the minds of the writers, you have to remember the writers were right in their 40s and 50s. I mean, there's a lot of Jack Benny references
right
in MASH too, and Jack Benny had been off the air for quite a long time. That's one of the amazing things about this show, about MASH, is how pop culture heavy it is. I mean, you think, oh, something like Big Bang Theory. It's like, no. Practically every other line of MASH is a reference to something from the 50s or the 40s or the 30s. I actually was hoping to go back and find in this episode an example of something which I could not find in this episode, but occurs a lot in the later episodes, which is the literateness of the doctors. If you ask somebody in the later seasons a question, the odds are the answer is going to be a pun, a spin on a movie title, a song lyric, something like that. This is such an intelligently written show. It just blew my mind. I ended up host a podcast on another network called Presenting the Transcription Feature, which talks about old-time radio broadcasts. And there is no doubt that my love of 30s, 40s, and 50s culture came from MASH, because there is such a dense, rich atmosphere of movies, comic books, TV shows. Well, not TV shows, excuse me, it's 1951. But everything that was pop culture made its way into MASH. And as a kid, you're like, you're in the 70s and you know very little about the 60s. You're watching a show set in the 50s with references to the 40s and 30s. When we did the musical 1776, I think I said that a solid knowledge of that movie, Looney Tunes cartoons, and MASH will take you through most of the history classes you're going to encounter.
That's very true.
And so watching this as a kid, I'm sure inspired me to find out more about what was going on. I may not even have heard of Shazam, but like, oh, there's a comic book. I should look into that.
By the way, I should say, you briefly see the comic book that Dennis Fimple is holding. And that is, for anyone who knows anything about comic books or Captain Marvel comic books, that is clearly not a Captain Marvel comic book.
Oh.
You can just tell by the artwork. There's no way that is John Costanza or Pete Costanza or C.C. Beck. That is clearly not it. And speaking of comic books, of course, when Frank and Hot Lips break into Henry's office and there's Radar sitting there, he is reading a comic book as well. He is reading Captain Savage number 10 from Marvel Comics, which was published in 1969, not 1953. So once again, Radar's comic book source comes from a time machine. It has nothing to do with what was published. And I've mentioned in previous episodes, I'm always sort of curious as to where these comic books come from. Because you could see that when they're making the show, they don't have the time or the effort to go and find a 1953 comic book. Because where would you get one of those? You know, pre-comic book stores, where would you get one of those? So I could see the prop master saying, go out to a newsstand and buy a comic book. But they didn't do that. These comic books that Radar was reading are like 7 to 8 years older or 5 years older than the show when it was made. And I have to think that the 20th Century Prop Department just had a stack of comic books for just such an occasion, and they didn't bother to update them. They just sat there and gathered dust when somebody would need one, and so that's why they're a couple of years old. They were bought in the late 60s, and they just never got updated. And so whoever was the prop person was like, oh, nobody's going to notice the difference. Just give this to Radar.
Oh, I wish I had taken notes on this. Okay, Henry is reading, like, Sports Illustrated or something like that. It's a big orange magazine. Oh, God, I watched another episode from a couple of anyways, that magazine reappears. That exact issue reappears.
Oh, does it really?
In another episode, probably later on this season, which makes me think, yeah, there must have just been a stack. It's like, get the magazine prop, get the book prop, get the comic book. You know, just had a set of them.
Yeah, and Sports Illustrated was not even around in 1953, so that's even a little far off, too. Speaking of weird dates, it meant when they do a fake Tuttle's profile, which is a really great scene where they go through all the stuff, they talk about that Tuttle was born in 1924, which means he went to medical school in Berlinisch Polytechnica around right after World War II, which is probably pretty unlikely for him to have done that. Frank comments, probably a Nazi. So.
Oh, I hadn't run the numbers. That's such a great scene. Although, don't military records usually like typed out?
Yeah, Hawkeye writes it longhand. Yeah, I would think that would be suspect to see somebody's personnel record just written in handwriting. But maybe Radar typed it up later or something. They're always giving him something to do.
It could be.
Speaking of which, his Tuttle's parents, Harry and Frieda Tuttle, those are Larry Gelbart's parents.
Oh, nice.
Those are the names of his parents. And Tuttle's Army serial number, 397-29966, is Larry Gelbart's Army serial number. So he's standing in there for for Larry Gelbart there.
Larry Gelbart got his start in old-time radio working for Bob Hope, and he went on several of Bob Hope's USO tours to Korea. So that's why when this show was presented to him, he's like, oh, I'm kind of uniquely qualified to help develop this. I remember some of the adventures and some of the stories.
I don't think I knew that. I knew that he worked in radio, but I don't think he knew that he went on with the trips with Bob Hope. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I imagine some of the stuff he might have seen. Actor-wise, of course, we have Herb Voland is back as Schoenel Clayton. I love Hawkeye's impersonation of him. Hey, Margaret. And he's like, I love the line about the, is this an obscene phone call? And Margaret goes, I wish it was, sir.
That's my second favorite joke. I'll save my first favorite for the end.
Okay.
But yeah, I love when people have to imitate other people. Isn't there an episode where I swear to God, Colonel Potter imitates either Klinger or Radar?
There's one where, well, there's a bunch. There's one where Klinger imitates Radar.
Okay.
There's one where Klinger imitates Potter. And there's one where Hawkeye imitates Winchester. Mm-hmm. And there's one where Henry imitates Henry Blake.
Okay.
Where he said, this is Colonel Blake. And he kind of like raises his voice. So he's doing, yeah, that is kind of funny having the actors parody one another. The other actors in this show, Mary Robin Redd. It plays Sister Teresa, the only time we ever see Sister Teresa. She was in credits include The Twilight Zone, Lou Grant, Heart to Heart. She was in the movie Man Trouble with Jack Nicholson. She was credited as intellectual-looking woman in Airplane 2. So there's that. And then, of course, the other famous face that most people know is playing the paymaster is James B. Sicking,
yeah.
Who was in Hill Street Blues, Doogie Howser, and most of us nerds know him as, of course, the commander of the Excelsior in Star Trek III. He's the one who tells Scotty we're going to be breaking some of the Enterprise speed records tomorrow. So, and of course, they get the drop on him in that movie.
Captain Stiles. I didn't watch Hill Street Blues that often, but I remember him as Hunter because he had that wonderful military look. He had like the cravat. And he had that wonderful cap with what we call scrambled eggs and things like that. He always looked so sharp.
Yeah, and he's still around. He's still doing stuff. So fun to see him. Fun to see him show up here. It is sort of funny. We were talking about again how well this is written. Is that they have to kind of keep the ball in the air and keep not showing Tuttle, but they have to show Tuttle. And of course, there's one point where Frank thinks Radar briefly is Tuttle.
Mm-hmm.
And then the scene where the mail comes and he goes, yo, and you see that it ends up being Hawkeye, but Hawkeye wearing his old hat that he wore in like the first couple episodes, which he gets rid of. So there he's Tuttle. And then later on when the paymaster shows up and Hawkeye full on says he is Tuttle. The one part about that scene that is really upsetting is that he signs the form with his bloody hospital gloves on.
Yeah.
And he hands the pen back to the paymaster. I'd be like, yeah, no thanks, buddy. Aren't you supposed to be a good doctor? What are you doing holding on to money and a pen with your bloody surgical gloves on?
Yep. And also, this is yet another episode which begins with Hawkeye and Trapper doing bad for all the right reasons.
Right, right.
I wish there weren't that many episodes. Oh, something I wanted to jump back to is, did you happen to notice the opening music? It's just,
you mean over the credits or the show itself?
The show itself, where it's this sort of creepy, spooky thing with
that theremin music that they like to play.
Yeah. It's like it's punctuated with just two or three phrases from Suicide is Painless. I don't usually notice the music, but it's like this is a really creepy opening.
They use this. I think it's the same music they use in Germ Warfare, where Hawkeye and Trapper are draining Frank's blood.
Okay,
they do. It's the weird, the weird theremin music. It's very, very strange. The end sequence where Hawkeye talks about what happened to Tuttle is that he jumped out of a helicopter without a parachute. That whole scene doesn't make a whole lot of sense because he says there's nothing left but his dog tags, and you're like, well, wait a minute. What, he died from falling out of a helicopter. Why would there be no body unless he hit a landmine or something?
Geez.
But you have to kind of just go blow past that. But I find it interesting is that if you look carefully, you notice two things. First of all, Trapper is not in the final scene at all. I don't understand that, but he's not. They never show him at any point. So Wayne Rogers must have not been available or something. And all the close-ups of Hawkeye are clearly shot on the set. The rest of it, it's outside. You can see everybody's outside on the lot, not on the lot, on the their outside camp set. But the close-ups of Alan Alda are done in the studio where they're having to fake it. Now, again, who knows? Maybe they must have had some trouble recording audio because there's a lot of
Oh, ADR.
A lot of ADR in this episode. The whole scene with Frank and Hot Lips, where they're romancing one another, is all ADR. So obviously they probably had a lot of some technical stuff here, and maybe the stuff they recorded with Alan Alda on the location wasn't recorded, it didn't sound right, so they had to go and do punch in. So all of a sudden you'll see the whole cast, and then you'll just do these singles of Alan Alda talking, responding, and they keep going back and forth. And so they have to cut it together the way they had to do some other episodes. But it's one of those things that growing up I never noticed, and then as I got older and I became more cognizant of how the show was constructed, I could see it's like, oh, Alan Alda's not there with the rest of them at any given yeah, point.
It's quite a lot. When Margaret and Frank are outside talking, that's some of my favorite characterization. I mean, Frank's whole reaction to Tuttle goes from first he feels bad because he thinks Tuttle's going to replace him. I mean, it's the whole everybody hates me theory. And then he starts to project onto Tuttle this whole friendship thing. First it's this potential friendship. He tells Henry, you know, he wants to room with him. He calls him Johnny.
Johnny, yeah.
He says the thing that we speak the same language. I mean, that's a real subtlety of characterization. We're only 15 episodes in. And for guys who – this was their first episode of MASH, they had a real connection to Frank. And, of course, Margaret, who's over-sexualized all these early episodes. I love her interaction with the colonel – or with the general. And there's always these suggestions that she slept with all these generals. If it weren't for the fact that she's depicted as such a competent nurse and such a competent head nurse, it would really be a sort of sexist bummer. But I mean, she uses Tuttle, you know, first to like get jealousy out of Frank. You know, not jealous, are you? She says. And you know, no matter how attractive I find Captain Tuttle, she plays Frank to get more attention. Margaret really just projects sex. And this is one of those episodes where she's called Hot Lips. And what I want to do is take just a second to talk about the secret origin of that nom de guerre, if I
may.
So, I mean, anybody who's seen the movie has seen the scene where Frank and Margaret are making out, and it's like, oh, kiss my lips are so hot. But that scene, that term predates the movie. It's in the book. Now, in the book, it's just random. Duke calls her Hot Lips. So much in that book is nicknames, slang, terms that are just like, it's not explained at all. You really have to read heavily into this. But I have a theory as to where this comes from. Admittedly, if I were a teacher, I would give myself a B on this because I'm about to make a few assumptions, but I think I can back some of this up, so stay with me. All right, our setting is 1950s Korea. I assume the characters in MASH listen to Armed Forces Radio Network. Now, in the TV show, we see them. We see them listening to baseball games and things like that. There are no references in the book to radio or to Lips, which is a real bummer. So we assume the characters listen to the Armed Forces Radio Network. A lot of shows broadcast are what are called transcription discs, which is to say shows were recorded basically onto records in America and shipped over. And that's why we still have shows from the 30s, 40s, and 50s that were on radio, as they were recorded. Okay, but we do know that the characters in MASH love nicknames, not just Hawkeye and Trapper, but they've given Radar the nickname Radar. In the book, in the movie, there's the Painless Pole. Who's Father Mulcahy's nickname?
Dago Red.
Dago Red. So they love nicknames. Okay, that's a known fact. Right? One of the most popular radio shows at the time was the Jimmy Durante Show. Now, you, Rob, are a fan of old-time television, old-time movies. You know Jimmy Durante, right? What was his nickname?
The old Schnozola?
The old Schnozola. And can you give me a Jimmy Durante impression?
I'm not good at impressions, but okay. This is the thing I know. Okay, hold on. Let me. Inka Dinka Doo.
Very good. He's got a million of them, folks.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, I really know him from It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, because he's the guy that dies at the beginning of that movie, and that's one of my – that's like my top five favorite movies of all time.
Oh, great. And other listeners, if you want to tune into Jimmy Durante, watch The Man Who Came to Dinner, where he plays a character called Banjo, who's sort of like a Harpo Marx sort of character. Okay, on The Jimmy Durante Show, there was a reoccurring character – a sexy-breath female, kind of like Kathleen Turner as Jessica Rabbit, who went by the name of Hot Breath Houlihan.
Oh, my Lord.
I kid
really?
Not. I kid you not. Hello, boys. It's your old friend Hot Breath Houlihan here. So, given the assumption that our characters listen to the radio, given the assumption they listen to Jimmy Durante, knowing that they love nicknames, and encountering the rather unusual last name of Houlihan, I do not think it's too much of a jump to have Duke, upon meeting a woman who's attractive, blonde, sort of willowy, and labeling her Hot Lips Houlihan. I declare that Richard Hooker got hot lips from Jimmy Durante. Jimmy Durante. That's my story. I'm sticking with it.
That's got to be it. That's too much of a coincidence. That has got to be it. That is nice job of pop culture archaeology there, Kevin. That's amazing. I will tell everybody on the show. Kevin did not tell me where he was going with this. He told me he was going to mention Jimmy Durante, but he didn't tell me anything else. That has got to be it. That has absolutely happened.
I stumbled upon that while listening to some old-time radio shows a while back, and I was like, what? What did she say? Hot Breath Houlihan? That's got to be it. And I think that's it.
That is so cool. I love it. Oh, my God. I learned something new about MASH now. I didn't think that was possible. this whole show's been worth it. Thank you, Kevin.
Hey.
That is really cool.
That actress on the radio was Florence Halep, who some people may know.
Florence Halep was Hot Breath Houlihan?
Yes, she was.
From Night Court?
From Night Court, Selma's replacement in season 3.
Oh my, and she was on St. Elsewhere too. She played that patient that kept coming back, was always sick, and they couldn't get rid of her. I can't believe, oh my Lord, that's unbelievable. Wow. That is very cool. That is fantastic. That
I'm is so cool. Glad I could take your day.
Oh man, that is great. We got to end the show here. That's it, man. That's we got to end the show on that. I do have one little detail I want to mention, and it's just in the end bit, of course, but they talk about Major Murdoch, where another little bit of unusual character is that Radar swills a martini. Well, I shouldn't say swill. He's never swilled a martini. But he just casually drinks a martini in that final shot, which, of course, he would never do.
Yeah.
Because in later episodes, he regards it like it's gasoline or something. But here, he's still kind of the more – he's not quite the simple buffoon the way they play him up in later episodes. And even in the very previous one, Love Story, he's a little more of a babe in the woods. But here, he's kind of more the greasy operator. And so he's just with the gang here with a Hawkeye and Trapper chugging a martini. But, you know, it's all right. They were still figuring this stuff out.
Yeah.
Wow. But we got to go back to Hot Breath Houlihan. That's amazing. That's absolutely got to be right. Very cool, Kevin. So, well, that's Tuttle. It's a really great episode. It's very funny. As you said, you don't really need to know it. There's nothing involving medicine. There's no patients or anything. So it really is kind of, it's a very sitcom-y episode. And as I said, under any other hands, I think it probably could have collapsed under its own weight, but it doesn't. This one just, it manages to keep it going, and it's very funny. And Hawkeye's whole line about, you could even say, you think in many ways all of us made up Tuttle, you know, like that line. It's very, very, very funny show. Do you have a particular favorite line?
Yeah, so my favorite line is actually when they're writing up Tuttle's bio, and it's like, religion? Druid. And Radar says, what's that? Hawkeye says, they pray at trees. Radar goes, tree surgeon.
Hawkeye makes a similar joke in a later episode too, where he talked about he talked about in the More I See You, where he says his apartment he painted it himself, and he says it was my hands were Hunter Green for a week. I told everybody I was a tree surgeon.
Yeah. It's one of those occasional scenes where Radar thinks he understands what's going on.
Yeah, nods his head. Yeah,
it doesn't quite.
My favorite line is also from that scene, is when he's writing the profile and Trapper compliments Hawkeye and he says, you're really good. You should write fiction. And Hawkeye says, you should read my profile.
Yeah.
I love that. Imagine what kind of crazy anti-military stuff is in Hawkeye's profile.
So, well, we know he did sign his loyalty oath. We know that.
That's right. That whole scene is fantastic. Yeah. That whole sequence of them writing the profile. Talk about that he's 6'4", and Trapper's like, Hawkeye, I think I'm in love. It's just great. The whole thing is funny from beginning to end. So, well, like I said, that's going to do it for Tuttle. A really, really great show. Kevin, thank you so much for coming on, man. I always enjoy talking to you. I'm glad we could have you on this show now, and you will absolutely be back for later episodes. Tell everybody where they can find your shows on the internet.
Sure. So if you listen to another network called the Chronic Rift Network, my show.
What?
You can cut that part out, right? Bleep it out. My show, Presenting the Transcription Feature, is on about twice a month. I present old-time radio shows, and I provide sort of, brief notes before each show. So if there's a joke about Alf Landon, you'll understand who Alf Landon was.
Wow.
But you can also, that's a deep cut. But you can also go to Kevin Lauderdale about livejournal.com. Gee, I think I should probably get like a geocities.com/Pendlejohn. But I am there and I post a few things every now and then. And I'm on Facebook. Most of my stuff is public.
KevinLauderdale.arpanet.gov. So, awesome. Well, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it. Again, it's always fun talking to you. And, of course, everybody, if you want to listen to back episodes of the show or leave comments, go to the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, and go on to Twitter where we're talking about the show over there as well at MASH4077cast. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Until the next episode, that is all.
Let's see, when was Tuttle born?
How about 1924? That was a good year for doctors.
Okay. Mother?
Yes.
Father?
One.
Harry and Frieda Tuttle. Birthplace?
Hey, how about my hometown?
No, they've already got enough to be proud of.
Victor, we're in luck. Standing in front of this theater is the newest sensation of the cinema.
Relax, boys. It's Hot Breath Houlihan.
She can't scorch me tonight. I had my nose in a deep freeze all week. But I'm glad your picture's a success here, Hot Breath. Tell me, is this your first trip to Chicago?
No. This is my second appearance.
What was your first?
You've heard of the Chicago Fire, haven't you?
Boy, I'd sure like to rub two of her together.
Yeah.